Secretary of War. Some in that body called the move audacious, others called it impudent. Whatever it was, Davis had the devotion of the people and the personal support of a majority of the legislators, and he was willing to risk them both here and now to get what he believed both he and the Confederacy needed to win the war and establish independence. And he got it. Despite the gasps of outrage and cries of indignation, Benjamin was quickly confirmed as head of the State Department and thus assured a voice in the nation's councils, a seat at the right hand of Jefferson Davis. Having angered many congressmen by requiring them to promote the Secretary of War as a reward for what they termed his inefficiency, the president now proceeded to make them happy and proud by placing before them for confirmation the name of George Wythe Randolph as Benjamin's successor. Appointment of this 44-year-old Richmond lawyer, scion of the proud clan of Randolph, would make amends for the snub given Hunter and restore to the Old Dominion a rightful place among those closest to the head of government. What was more, Randolph had had varied military experience as a youthful midshipman in the U.S. Navy, as a gentleman ranker in a pre-war Richmond militia company, and as artillery commander under Magruder on the peninsula, where in 8 months he had risen from captain to colonel, with a promotion to brigadier moving up through channels even now. All this was much, and augured well. But best of all, from the point of view of those who had the privilege of voting his confirmation, he was the grandson of Thomas Jefferson, born at the hilltop shrine of Monticello and dandled on the great Virginian's knee. Blood would tell, as all Southerners knew, and this was the finest blood of all, serving to re-emphasize the ties between the Second American Revolution and the First. The appointment was confirmed at once, enthusiastically and with considerable mutual congratulation among the senators. Whether the high-born Randolph would bear up better than Hunter had done as a clerk of Mr. Davis remained to be seen. For the present, at least, the chief executive had placated the rising anger of his friends by nominating Randolph, and had foiled his critics by tossing his personal popularity into the balance alongside the hated Benjamin, causing the opposite pan to kick the beam. How long he could continue to win by such methods, standing thus between his favorites and abuse, was another question. Certainly every such victory subtracted from the weight he would exert in any weighing match that followed. What he lost each time, his critics gained, particularly those who railed against his static defensive policy and his failure to share with the public the grim statistics of the lengthening odds. Down in Georgia, even now, an editor was writing for all to read, "President Davis does not enjoy the confidence of the Southern people. With a cold, icy iron grasp, he has fettered our people, stilled their beating pulses of patriotism, cooled their fiery ardor, imprisoned them in camps and behind entrenchments. He has not told the people what he needed. As a faithful sentinel, he has not told them what of the night." So far, the Georgian was one among a small minority, but such men were vociferous in their bitterness, and when they stung to hurt. The people read or heard their complaints printed in columns alongside the news of such reverses as Fort Donelson and Roanoke Island, and they wondered. They did not enjoy being told that they were not trusted by the man in whom their own trust was placed. A South Carolina matron, friendly to Davis and all he stood for, confided scornfully in her diary, "In Columbia, I do not know a half-dozen men who would not gaily step into Jeff Davis's shoes with a firm conviction that they would do better in every respect than he does." There was one glimmer in the military gloom, indeed a brightness, though it was based not on accomplishment but on continuing confidence despite the lengthening odds and the late reverses. The gleam, in fact, proceeded from the region where the gloom was deepest, off in the panic-stricken West, where the left wing of the Confederacy had been crippled. What his wife represented in private life, what Benjamin meant to him in helping to meet the cares of office, Albert Sidney Johnston was to Davis in military matters. He was in plain fact his notion of a hero. They had not been together since mid-September, when the tall, handsome, Kentucky-born Texan came to Richmond to receive from Davis his commission and his assignment to command of the Western Department. That had been a happy time, the plaudits of the entire nation ringing in his ears. They had kept on ringing, too, until Grant called his game of bluff on the Tennessee and the Cumberland, and the whole Western House of Cards went crash. At the outset, the newspapers had expected results at once brilliant, scientific, and satisfactory. The diminution of the adjectives was prophetic. But not this. Not defeat, with the loss of half his army, all of Kentucky, and a goodly portion of Tennessee, including its capital. The uproar outdid anything the nation had known since the defection of Benedict Arnold. Johnston was accused of stupidity and incompetence, or worse, for there were the usual post-defeat cries of treason and corruption. Those who had sung his praises loudest such a short while back were loudest now in abuse. The army was demoralized, they shrilled. Johnston must be removed, or the cause would fail. New troops being sworn in made it a condition of their enlistment oath that they would not be required to serve under his command. He took the blame as he had taken the praise. Calm at the storm center, he displayed still the nobility of mind and strength of character which had drawn men to him all his life. Urged by friends to make a public defense, he replied, "I cannot correspond with the people. What the people want is a battle and a victory. That is the best explanation I can make." Retreating again from Murfreesboro now all the way to Decatur, Alabama, where he would be south of the Tennessee River and on the Memphis and Charleston Railroad, in a position to cooperate with the forces under Beauregard, retreating south along the Mississippi, he wrote to Davis more explicitly of his reason for keeping his temper. "I observed silence, as it seemed to me the best way to serve the cause and the country." He offered then to yield the command, saying, "The test of merit in my profession is success. It is a hard rule, but I think it right." To concentrate and strike was his present aim, in which case, those who are now declaiming against me will be without an argument. It was a letter to warm the heart of any superior in distress, which Davis certainly was. He replied, "My confidence in you has never wavered, and I hope the public will soon give me credit for judgment rather than continue to arraign me for obstinacy." The public might, in time, but for the present the clamor did not die. It grew. Davis stood under an avalanche of letters, protests, and demands for his friend's dismissal. Yet all this time, as he said, he never wavered. When a delegation of Tennessee congressmen called at his office to insist en masse that Johnston be relieved, he was no general, they said scornfully. Davis stood at his desk and heard their demand with an icy silence. When they had spoken, he told them, "If Sidney Johnston is not a general, we had better give up the war, for we have no general," and bowed them out. The other Johnston, back in Virginia, was another matter. There would never be any such letter from him, and Davis knew it, not only because it was not in Joe Johnston's nature to be selfless in a crisis, he had small belief in the efficacy of silence, but also because his problems were quite different. He had no quarrel with the public, like his soldiers, now and always, showed the greatest affection for him. His difficulties were rather with his superiors, the Commander-in-Chief and the Secretary of War, and with the laws and regulations which Congress passed in an attempt to be what it called helpful, but which Johnston himself considered meddlesome and harmful. A case in point was the so-called Furlough and Bounty Act, which had been passed in December, in an effort to meet the crisis that would arise when the enlistments of the 12-month volunteers expired in late winter and early spring. Obviously, something would have to be done to encourage re-enlistments. Few men were likely to expose themselves voluntarily to a continuance of the dull life they had been leading all through the Virginia fall and winter. Under the Act, all who would sign on for 3 years, or the duration in case the end came first, would receive a 60-day furlough and a $50 bounty. Further, on their return, they would be allowed to transfer to whatever outfit they chose, even into another arm of service, and elect their own field and company-grade officers once the reorganization was effected. Johnston realized the necessity for some such encouragement, but the only part of this particular act that he approved of was the bounty. The transfer and election privileges he considered ruinous, and the furloughs, if granted in numbers large enough to be effective, would expose the remainder of his army to slaughter at the hands of the Federals, already twice his strength around Manassas and likely to attack at any time. Besides, when he wrote to the War Department asking how the act was to be applied and what numbers were to be furloughed at any one time, the secretary replied that he was to go to the extreme verge of prudence. Now, Johnston was a very prudent man, entirely too much so, his critics said. The extreme verge of his prudence was still very prudent indeed. As a result, the act accomplished little except to vex the general charged with its application. Another more serious vexation was the loss of experienced officers of rank. He had lost the embittered Beauregard, and he had nearly lost Stonewall Jackson as a result of Benjamin's out-of-channels interference. Kirby Smith had returned to duty, healed of his Manassas wound, only to be assigned to deal with the powder keg East Tennessee situation. Earl Van Dorn, whose dash and brilliance promised much, had been sent to the Trans-Mississippi. These were hard losses, and there were more, in addition to some who were so disgruntled that they threatened to resign. The army is crippled and its discipline greatly impaired by a want of general officers, Johnston reported plaintively to Richmond. These were causes enough for disturbance in any commander, let alone one as irascible and gloomy as Joe Johnston, but coming as they did, at a time when the odds were what he knew them to be in Northern Virginia, they filled him with forebodings of disaster. His loss of respect for McClellan's character as a man of war, in letters he now referred to him as George, or the redoubtable McSee, or even, quote, George, unquote, employing the pointed sarcasm of inverted commas, did not preclude a respect for McClellan's numbers or his ability to forge them into an effective striking force. And not only were the numerical odds forbidding, the situation itself was bad from the southern point of view. Operating behind the screen of the Potomac, the northern host could concentrate and strike at any point from the Blue Ridge Mountains down to Aquia Creek, and thus be on the flank or in the rear of the army around Manassas and Occoquan. All that was holding them back, so far as Johnston could see, was rainy weather and the mud that it produced. Spring was coming, the sudden vernal loveliness of blue skies, new grass, and solid roads. A week of sunshine would remove all the obstacles that stood between McClellan and success, or between Johnston and ruin. It was at this point, aggravated further by a shortage of arms and powder, that the general was summoned to ride down to Richmond, 2 days before the inauguration, for a conference on the military situation. Reporting to the president at 10 o'clock that morning, he found the cabinet in session and the discussion already begun. After an exchange of greetings in which there was no evidence of the lately strained relations, he was asked to state his views as to the disposition of his army. He replied that from its present position along Bull Run and the Potomac, it could not block the multiple routes by which McClellan could march against the capital. Unequivocally, he stated that his army must fall back to a position farther south before the roads were dry. Somewhat taken aback, Davis asked to just what line the retreat would be conducted. When Johnston replied that he did not know, being unfamiliar with the country between Richmond and Manassas, Davis was even more alarmed. As he said later, that a general should have selected a line which he himself considered untenable and should not have ascertained the typography of the country in his rear, was inexplicable on any other theory than that he had neglected the primary duty of a commander. For the present, however, he let this pass. If Johnston advised retreat, retreat it had to be, so long as he was in command. Davis had to content himself with trying to get assurances from the general that the Army's supplies and equipment, particularly the large-caliber guns along the Potomac and the mountains of subsistence goods now stored in forward depots, would not be abandoned. He did not get it. Johnston merely said that he would do what he could to delay the retreat until the last possible moment, so that the roads would be firm enough to bear the heavy guns and the high-piled wagons. Further than that, he would not go. The meeting broke up without any specific date being set for the withdrawal. All that was determined was that the army would move southward to take up a securer line whenever practicable. Back at his hotel, it was Johnston's turn to be alarmed. He found the lobby buzzing with rumors that the Manassas entrenchments were about to be abandoned. The news had moved swiftly before him, though he had come directly from the conference, with the result that his reluctance to discuss military secrets with civilians, no matter how highly placed, was confirmed. No tactical maneuver was more difficult than a withdrawal from the presence of a superior enemy. Everything depended on secrecy, for to be caught in motion, strung out on the roads, was to invite destruction. Yet here in the lobby of a Richmond hotel, where every pillar might hide a spy, was a flurry of gossip predicting the very movement he was about to undertake. Next day, riding back to Manassas on the cars, his reluctance was reconfirmed and his anger heightened when a friend approached and asked if it was true that the Bull Run line was about to be abandoned. There could be no chance that the man had overheard the news by accident, for he was deaf. Nor did it improve the general's humor when he arrived that afternoon to find his headquarters already abuzz with talk of the impending evacuation. Two things he determined to do in reaction. One, to get his army out of there as quickly as he could, if possible before McClellan had time to act on the leaked information. And two, to confide no more in civilians, which, as far as he was concerned, included the chief executive. The first was easier said than done, however. Rain fell all the following day, drenching alike the inaugural throng on Capitol Square and the roads of northern Virginia. The army was stalled in a sea of mud, just when Johnston was most anxious to get it moving. Well-mounted cavalry, riding light, could not average 2 miles an hour along the roads. Four-horse teams could not haul the field artillery guns, and nothing at all could budge the heavier pieces. The general's determination to share none of his plans with the government did not prevent his expressing his ire and apprehension in dispatches which repeated his former complaints and advanced new ones. "A division of 5 brigades is without generals," he wrote on the 25th, "and at least half the field officers are absent, generally sick. The accumulation of subsistence stores at Manassas is now a great evil. The commissary general was requested more than once to suspend these supplies. A very extensive meatpacking establishment at Thoroughfare is also a great encumbrance. The great quantities of personal property in our camps is a still greater one." He did what he could to hasten his army's departure, but with horses and wagons foundered and mired on the roads, he had to depend solely on the single-track Orange and Alexandria Railroad. Overcrowded, it quickly snarled to a standstill and pitched the general's anguished cries an octave higher. In truth, there was much to vex him here where ruin stared him in the face. The amount of personal baggage piled along the railroad was appalling to behold, one witness said. A trunk had come with every volunteer, Johnston later declared, reporting now that the army, over his protest, had accumulated a supply of baggage like that of Xerxes's myriads. All this time, while he was struggling to save what he could with so little success, there had been reports of enemy advances, each a confirmation of his fears. Soon after his return from the capital, a Union force had appeared at Harper's Ferry, from which position it could move forward and outflank him on the left. 2 weeks later, March 5th, he was warned of unusual activity on the Maryland shore opposite Dumfries, indicating preparations for attack. This was the movement he feared most, considering it not only the most dangerous, but also the most likely. An advance from there would turn his right and bring the Federals between his army and Richmond. That did it. He did not intend to let himself get caught like that other Johnston in the West, who lost half his army through delay in pulling back when enemy pressure increased the strain beyond the breaking point. To retreat now meant the loss of much equipment. The heavy guns were still in place along the Potomac. Supplies and personal baggage were still piled high along the railroad. But equipment was nothing compared to the probable loss of men and possible loss of the war itself. Nor was terrain, not even the sacred soil of his native state. That same day he issued orders for all his forces east of the Blue Ridge to fall back to the line of the Rappahannock. Davis in Richmond knew nothing of this. Ever since Johnston's departure, he had been urging a delay in the retrograde movement. In fact, when Virginia officials came to him with a plan for mass recruitment to turn back the invaders, Davis took heart and urged the general to hold his ground while the army was brought up to strength for an offensive, which he now referred to as first policy. March 10th, believing that Johnston and his army still held the Manassas entrenchments, he wired, "Further assurance given to me this day that you shall be promptly and adequately reinforced, so as to enable you to maintain your position and resume first policy when the roads will permit." Johnston was not there to receive it, nor were any of his men. The cavalry rear guard had pulled out that morning, following the southward trail of the army on its way to the Rappahannock, accompanied by its general, who was already contemplating another retreat, from there back to the Rapidan. The one in progress had not gone well. One division in an advanced position had not been informed of the movement at all, but was left to find its way out as best it could. The heavy guns were left in their emplacements, some of them not even thrown from their carriages. Supplies and equipment, including the trunks the volunteers had brought, went up in smoke. The packing plant at Thoroughfare Gap was put to the torch, along with 1,000,000 pounds of meat remaining after farmers in the neighborhood had been given all they could haul away. For 20 miles around, all down the greening slopes of Bull Run Mountain, there was a smell of burning bacon, an aroma which the natives would remember through the hungry months ahead. 4. Lincoln's efforts all this time as commander-in-chief, though on the face of it they were exerted in quite the opposite direction and for an entirely different purpose, were much like those of his southern counterpart. For while Davis had been trying to get Johnston to hold his ground, Lincoln had been doing his best to nudge McClellan forward. All through the fall and winter, as far as these two tasks were concerned, Lincoln had failed and Davis had succeeded. Both generals stayed exactly where they were. Yet in the end it was the northern leader who was successful. Johnston fell back and McClellan at last went forward. In both cases, however, on that final day, March 9th, the civilian heads were shown to have urged good counsel to generals who now were exposed before the public in a cold, unflattering light. Johnston fled where no man pursued, and McClellan encountered none of the bloody opposition he had predicted. For both civil leaders, the time had been long and harrowing, a season of waste and unhappiness for Lincoln no less than for Davis. The burden of action was on the North. The South had only to keep the status quo, which was exactly what she had been doing here in Virginia. If on the northern side the gloom had been relieved by victories east and west, Roanoke Island and Fort Donelson, it had no bright original face-to-face east-west triumph such as Manassas or Wilson's Creek to hark back to. Also, for Lincoln, the period of inaction around Washington had been darkened by personal tragedy, including the death of one of his sons and signs that his wife was losing her mind. For him, the year had opened not with a glimmer as of dawn, but rather with gathering shadows as of dusk. The army head was down with typhoid, the bottom was out of the tub. "What shall I do?" he groaned in his melancholy. It was January 10th. Quartermaster General M.C. Meigs replied that if the typhoid diagnosis was correct, It meant a 6 weeks' illness for McClellan, during which time the nation's armies would be leaderless and vulnerable. He suggested that the president call a conference of the ranking officers of the Army of the Potomac, one of whom might have to take over in a crisis. Lincoln liked the advice and called the meeting for that evening. Two generals attended, McDowell and William B. Franklin, along with several cabinet members. Lincoln told them the situation and expressed his desire for an early offensive. If McClellan did not want to use the army, he said, he would like to borrow it for a while. McDowell replied that he would be willing to try his hand at another advance on Richmond by way of Manassas, while Franklin, who had taken part in that first debacle under McDowell and was moreover in the confidence of McClellan, favored the roundabout saltwater route, approaching the southern capital from the east. On this divided note, the conference adjourned. Next night, when they met again, the generals were agreed that the overland method was best, despite the previous failure, because it would require less time for preparation. Pleased with this decision, Lincoln adjourned the second meeting, instructing the generals to go back to their headquarters, work on the plan, and return tomorrow night. They did return, having worked on it all through the day, but the third White House session was brief, since they still had much to do. The fourth such conference on the 13th was the last. McClellan was there, pale and shaky, but very much there. He had gotten wind of what was going on, perhaps from Stanton, who had been visiting him and murmuring, "They are counting on your death." Stanton was adept at this kind of thing, having served in Buchanan's cabinet as an informer for the opposition. Anyhow, McClellan had learned of the meetings and had risen from his sickbed to confront these men who met behind his back. As a result, the atmosphere was strained. According to McClellan, "My unexpected appearance caused very much the effect of a shell in a powder magazine." When Lincoln asked McDowell to outline the plan he had been working on, McDowell gave it nervously and wound up with an apology for offering his opinion in the presence of his chief. "You are entitled to have any opinion you please," McClellan said, obviously miffed. During the discussion which followed, while Lincoln kept asking where and when an offensive could be launched, McClellan remained silent. Seward drawled that he didn't much care whether the army whipped the rebels at Manassas or in Richmond itself, so long as it whipped them somewhere. McClellan kept silent. Finally, Chase questioned him directly, asking what he intended to do with the army and when he intended to do it. The general replied that he had a perfectly good plan with a perfectly good schedule of execution, but he would not discuss it in front of civilians unless the president ordered him to do so. He would say, however, that Buell was about to move forward in Kentucky, after which he himself would move. Another awkward silence followed. Presently, Lincoln asked him if he counted upon any particular time. He was not asking him to divulge it, he added hastily. He just wanted to know if he had it in mind. McClellan said he did. "Then I will adjourn this meeting," Lincoln said. McClellan did not go back to his sickbed. Now that he was up, he stayed up. His youth and stout constitution, he had reached 35 in December, permitting him to convalesce on horseback, so to speak. Once more he spent long days in the saddle and nights in the office, riding to inspect the camps and returning with a jaunty salute the worshipful cheers of his soldiers. There was something other than cheering in the air, however. For one thing, there was suspicion, which meant that the Joint Committee on the Conduct of the War was interested. Now that he was up where they could get at him, the committeemen summoned the general to appear and be examined. Ben Wade and Zachariah Chandler, who, along with Andrew Johnson, were the members from the Senate, did most of the questioning. Chandler began it by asking why the army, after 5 long months of training, was not marching out to meet the enemy. McClellan began explaining that there were only 2 bridges across to Alexandria, which did not satisfy the requirement that a commander must safeguard his lines of retreat in event that his men were repulsed. "General McClellan," Chandler interrupted. He spoke with the forthright tone of a man translating complicated matters into simpler terms for laymen. If I understand you correctly, before you strike at the rebels, you want to be sure of plenty of room so you can run in case they strike back. Or in case you get scared, Wade put in. McClellan then went into a rather drawn-out explanation of how wars were fought. Lines of retirement were sometimes as necessary to an army's survival, he said, as lines of communication and supply. The committeemen listened scornfully. It was not this they had called him in to tell them. "General," Wade said, "you have all the troops you have called for, and if you haven't enough, you shall have more. They are well organized and equipped, and the loyal people of this country expect that you will make a short and decisive campaign. Is it really necessary for you to have more bridges over the Potomac before you move?"
Not that exactly," McClellan told him. "But we must bear in mind the necessity of having everything ready in case of a defeat, and keep our lines of retreat open."
After this, they let him go in disgust. When he had gone, Chandler turned to Wade and sneered. "I don't know much about war," he said, "but it seems to me that this is infernal, unmitigated cowardice." Wade thought so too, and as chairman he went to see Lincoln about it. "McClellan must be discarded," he cried. When the president asked who should be put in his place, Wade snorted, "Anybody." "Wade," Lincoln replied sadly, "anybody will do for you, but I must have somebody." Already that week he had made one replacement in a high place. For months now there had been growing reports of waste and graft in the War Department, of contracts strangely let, of shoddy cloth, tainted pork, spavined horses, and guns that would not shoot, of the Vermont jobber who boasted at Willard's, grinning, "You can sell anything to the government at almost any price you've got the guts to ask." Simon Cameron was responsible, though there was no evidence that the secretary had profited personally except in the use of his office to pay off his political debts and strengthen his political position. Lincoln could understand this last, having himself done likewise. In point of fact, that was how Cameron got the job. And he knew, too, that much of the waste and bungling, much of the greed and dishonesty even, was incident to the enormous task of preparing the unprepared nation for war, and increasing the army from 16,000 to better than 500,000 men in the process. All the same, the Pennsylvanian was unquestionably lax in his conduct of business affairs, and when Lincoln warned him of this, resisting the general outcry for his removal, Cameron made his first really serious mistake. He made it, however, not through any ordinary brand of stupidity. Cameron was a very canny man, but rather through his canniness in trying to safeguard his position in the cabinet by strengthening his position in the public eye and in the minds of the increasingly powerful radicals in Congress. He fell because he did what many men had done before and what others would do in the future, after he himself was off the scene. He underestimated Lincoln. Despite the example of Fremont, or perhaps because he thought that the furor which had followed Fremont's dismissal would have taught Lincoln a lesson, Cameron reasoned that by ingratiating himself with the Jacobins, he would insure himself against any action by the president, who would not dare to antagonize them further by molesting another man who had won their favor. Any attack on slavery was the answer. Emancipation was the issue on which Lincoln was treading softest, since it was the one that cut sharpest along the line dividing the administration's supporters and opponents. Accordingly, with the help of his legal adviser, Stanton, Cameron drafted and included in his annual department report a long passage advocating immediate freedom for Southern slaves and their induction into the Union Army, thereby adding muscle to the arm of the Republic and weakening the enemy, who, as rebellious traitors, had forfeited their rights to any property at all, let alone the ownership of fellow human beings. Without consulting the president, though it was usual for such documents to be submitted for approval, the secretary had the report printed and sent out to the postmasters of all the principal cities for distribution to the press as soon as it was being read to Congress.
So far, all was well. Even when Lincoln discovered what had been done and recalled the pamphlet by telegraphic order for reprinting without the offensive passage, things still went as Cameron had expected. Critics of the president's tread-easy policy, comparing the original with the expurgated report — some copies, of course, escaped destruction so that both versions appeared in the papers — were harsh in their attacks, charging Lincoln simultaneously with dictatorship and timidity. The Jacobins reacted as expected by taking the secretary to their bosoms and pronouncing him one of us. Other praises came his way, less vigorous perhaps, but no less pleasant. "You have touched the national heart," a friend declared, while another, in a punning mood, wrote that he much preferred the Simon Pure article in the Tribune to the bogus report in the World. From Paris, a member of the consulate, hearing of the dissension in the president's official family, wrote home asking, "Are Cameron and Fremont to be canonized as martyrs?" Cameron might be canonized, at any rate, by the anti-slavery radicals, but it did not appear that he would be martyred by anyone, least of all by Lincoln, who seemed to have learned a dearly bought lesson in martyring Fremont. The report had been published in mid-December, and now in January he still had made no further reference to the matter. Outwardly, the relationship between the two men remained cordial, though Cameron still felt some inward qualms. Perhaps because he sensed that Lincoln's measure was not so easily taken. The thing had gone too well. Then on January 11th, a Saturday, the date of the second of the three conferences with McDowell and Franklin, none of which Cameron had been urged to attend, despite his position as Secretary of War, he learned that he had been right to feel qualms. He received a brief note in which Lincoln informed him curtly out of the blue, "I propose nominating you to the Senate next Monday as minister to Russia." Almost literally, he was being banished to Siberia for his sins. The sins were political, and as a politician he could appreciate the justice of his punishment. He suffered anguish, though, at the manner in which it was inflicted. To be rebuked thus in a brief note, he complained, meant personal as well as political destruction. So Lincoln, who cared little for the manner of his going, just so he went, agreed that Cameron might antedate a letter of resignation, to which he would reply with a letter of acceptance, expressing his affectionate esteem and undiminished confidence in the secretary's ability, patriotism, and fidelity to the public trust. It was done accordingly, and Cameron's name was sent to Congress for confirmation as minister to Russia. There, however, he encountered opposition, not only from members of his own party, the Democrats, but also from some of the radical Republicans, who so lately had clustered round him and proclaimed him one of us. At last the nomination was put through. Cameron was on his way to St. Petersburg, having earned not martyrdom and canonization, as some had hoped or feared, but banishment and damage to a reputation already considered shaky. One senator, a former colleague, remarked on his departure, "Ugh, ugh, send word to the Tsar to bring in his things of knights." In this case, Lincoln engaged in no fruitless search for somebody to replace him. The somebody was ready and very much at hand. Edwin McMasters Stanton, who as his predecessor's legal adviser had helped to charge and fuse the bomb that blew him out of the War Department and the Cabinet, while Stanton himself was sucked into the resultant vacuum and sat ensconced as successor before all the bits of wreckage had hit the ground. Whether he had proceeded with malice aforethought in this instance was not known, but it was not unthinkable. Stanton had done devious things in his time. A corporation lawyer, he delighted also in taking criminal cases when these were challenging and profitable enough. His fees were large, and when one prospective client protested, Stanton asked, "Do you think I would argue the wrong side for less?" For a murder defense, he once took as his fee the accused man's only possession, the house he lived in. When he had won the case and was about to convert the mortgage into cash, the man tried to persuade him to hold off, saying that he would be ruined by the foreclosure. "You deserve to be ruined," Stanton told him, for you were guilty. And yet there was another side to him, too, offsetting the savagery, the joy he took in fixing a frightened general or petitioner with the baleful glare of his black little nearsighted eyes behind small, thick-lensed oval spectacles. He was a bundle of contradictions, his father a New Englander, his mother a Virginian. In private, the 47-year-old lawyer sometimes put his face in his hands and wept from the strain. And if his secretary happened in at such a time, he would say, "Not now, please, not now." He was asthmatic, something of a hysteric as well, and he had more than a touch of morbidity in his nature. His bushy hair was thinning at the front, but he made up for this by letting it grow long at the back and sides. His upper lip he kept clean-shaven to expose a surprisingly sensitive mouth, a reminder that he had been considered handsome in his youth, while below his lower lip a broad streak of iron gray ran down the center of his wide black beard. His body was thick-set, bouncy on short but energetic legs. His voice, which was deep in times of calm, rose to piercing shrillness and excitement. One petitioner, badly shaken by the experience, described a Stanton interview by saying, "He came at me like a tiger." He came at many people like a tiger, especially at those in his department who showed less devotion to work than he himself did. Soon after he took office, he received from Harper's Ferry an urgent call for heavy guns. He ordered them sent at once. Going by the locked arsenal after hours, he learned that the guns were still there. Whereupon he ordered the gates broken open, helped the watchman drag the guns out, and saw them loaded onto a northbound train. Next morning, the arsenal officer reported that he had not found it convenient to ship the guns the day before. He would get them off this morning, he said. "The guns are now at Harper's Ferry," Stanton barked. "And you, sir, are no longer in the service of the United States government." He would engage in no secret deals. Whoever came to him on business, as for instance seeking a contract, was required to make his request in the sight and hearing of all. Stanton would snap out a yes or no, then wave him on to make way for the next petitioner. He did not care whose toes he stepped on. "Individuals are nothing," he declared. To a man who came demanding release for a friend locked up on suspicion of treason, Stanton roared, "If I tap that little bell, I can send you to a place where you will never hear the dogs bark. And by heaven, I'll do it if you say another word." He brought to the War Department a boundless and bounding energy. "As soon as I can get the machinery of the office working, the rats cleared out and the rat holes stopped," he told an assistant, "we shall move." Lincoln himself was by no means exempt from Stanton's scorn. Asked when he took office, "What will you do?" "Do," he replied, "I will make Abe Lincoln President of the United States." The government could use such a man, despite his idiosyncrasies, his sudden judgments, and hostile attitude. So could Lincoln use him in his official family, despite the abuse he knew that Stanton had been heaping on him since they first met in Cincinnati, when the big-time lawyer referred to the country one as that long-armed creature. More recently, he had been employing circus epithets. The original gorilla, he called him, a low, cunning clown, and that giraffe. Lincoln knew of some of this, but he still thought he could use him, provided he could handle him. And he believed he could. Stanton's prancing and bouncing, he said, put him in mind of a Methodist preacher out west who got so wrought up in his prayers and exhortations that his congregation was obliged to put bricks in his pockets to hold him down. "We may have to serve Stanton the same way," Lincoln drawled, "but I guess we'll let him jump a while first." The bricks were applied much sooner than anyone expected. One day the president was busy with a roomful of people, and Stanton came hurrying through the doorway, clutching a sheet of paper in his hand. "Mr. President," he cried, "this order cannot be signed. I refuse to sign it." Lincoln told him calmly, "Mr. Secretary, I guess that order will have to be signed." In the hush that followed, the two men's eyes met. Then Stanton turned, still with the order in his hand, and went back to his office and signed it. Whether or not McClellan could handle him too was one of the things that remained to be seen. At the outset, the general had good cause to believe that the change in War Department heads would work to his advantage. For on the evening of January 13th, the one on which he rose from his sickbed to confront the men who had been conferring behind his back, Stanton came by his quarters and informed him that his nomination as Secretary of War had gone to the Senate that afternoon. Personally, he went on to say, he considered the job a hardship, but the chance of working in close harness with his friend McClellan persuaded him to undergo the sacrifice involved. If the general would approve, he would accept. McClellan did approve. He urged acceptance on those grounds. 2 days later, the nomination was confirmed. Stanton took the post the following day. And almost immediately, from that January 16th on, McClellan found the doors of the War Department barred to him. The secretary, suddenly hostile, became at once the young Napoleon's most outspoken critic. McClellan had been given another lesson in the perfidy of the human animal. One more had been added at the top to that set of men unscrupulous and false. What he did not know was that all this time Stanton had been working both sides of the street. While his name was up for approval in the Senate, Charles Sumner was saying, "Mr. Stanton, within my knowledge, is one of us." Ben Wade thought so too, and on the day the new secretary moved into office, their opinion was confirmed. After saying that he was going to make Abe Lincoln president, Stanton added that as the next order of business, "I will force this man McClellan to fight or throw up." Later that same day he said baldly, "This army has got to fight or run away, and while men are striving nobly in the West, the champagne and oysters on the Potomac must be stopped." Formerly he had run with the fox and hunted with the hounds. Now he was altogether with the latter. On January 20th, at his own request, he appeared before the Joint Committee, and after the hearing, its members were loud in his praise. "We are delighted with him," Julian of Indiana exclaimed. In the Senate, Fessenden of Maine announced, "He is just the man we want. We agree on every point. The duties of the Secretary of War, the conduct of the war, the Negro question, and everything." In the Tribune, Horace Greeley hailed him as the man who would know how to deal with the greatest danger now facing the country. Treason in Washington, treason in the army itself, especially the treason which wears the garb of unionism. Treason was a much-used word these days. For Greeley to use it 3 times within a dependent clause was nothing rare. In fact, it was indicative. The syllables had a sound that caught men's ears, overtones of enormity that went beyond such scarehead words as rape or arson or incest. Observing this, the radicals had made it their watchword, their cry in the night, expanding its definition in the process. Many acts were treasonous now which had never been considered so before. Even a lack of action might be treason, according to these critics in long-skirted broadcloth coats. Delay, for instance. All who counseled delay were their special targets, along with those who favored something less than extermination for rebels. Obviously, the way to administer sudden death was to march out within musket range and bang away until the serpent rebellion squirmed no more. And as a rallying cry, this forthright logic was effective. Up till now, the administration's opposition had been no more than an incidental irritant. By mid-January of this second calendar year of the war, however, so many congressmen had discovered the popular value of pointing a trembling finger at treason in high places that their conglomerate harping voice had grown into a force which had to be reckoned with as surely as the Confederates still entrenched around Manassas. Lincoln the politician understood this perfectly. They were men with power who knew how to use it ruthlessly, and as such they would have to be dealt with. McClellan the soldier could never see it at all, partly because he operated under the disadvantage of considering himself a gentleman.
For him they were willful, evil men, unscrupulous and false, and as such they should be ignored as beneath contempt, at least by him. He counted on Lincoln to keep them off his back, which Lincoln, in fact, had promised to do. "I intend to be careful and do as well as possible," McClellan had said. "Don't let them hurry me, is all I ask." And Lincoln had told him, "You shall have your own way in the matter, I assure you." Yet now he seemed to be breaking his promise to McClellan, just as he had broken his word to Fremont, whom he had told, "I have given you carte blanche. You must use your own judgment and do the best you can." Fremont had used his judgment, such as it was, and been flung aside. McClellan was discouraged. That was something else he never understood. Lincoln himself. Some might praise him for being flexible, while others called him slippery, when in truth they were both two words for just one thing. To argue the point was to insist on a distinction that did not exist. Lincoln was out to win the war, and that was all he was out to do for the present. Unfettered by any need for being or not being a gentleman, he would keep his word to any man only so long as keeping it would help to win the war. If keeping it meant otherwise, he broke it. He kept no promise, anyhow, any longer than the conditions under which it was given obtained. And if any one thing was clear in this time when treason had become a household word, it was that the conditions of 3 months ago no longer obtained. McClellan would have to go forward or go down. On January 27th, without consulting anyone, least of all McClellan, Lincoln himself composed and issued over his signature as Commander-in-Chief of the nation's military forces, General War Order No. 1, in which he announced that a forward movement by all land and naval units would be launched on February 22nd, to celebrate Washington's birthday and also, presumably, to disrupt the Confederate inaugural in Richmond. It was not a suggestion or even a directive. It was a peremptory order, and as such it stated that all commanders afield or afloat would severally be held to their strict and full responsibilities for its prompt execution. Lest there be any misunderstanding as to whether this applied to the General-in-Chief and his army around Washington, Lincoln supplemented this with a special order 4 days later, directing that on or before the date announced, an expedition would move out from the Capitol, leaving whatever force would ensure the city's safety, and seize a point on the railroad southwestward of Manassas Junction. McClellan was aghast. He had counted on the president to keep the hot-eyed amateurs off his back. Yet here, by a sudden and seemingly gleeful leap, Lincoln had landed there himself, joining the others in an all-out game of pile-on. Besides, committed as he was to the Urbana plan for loading his army on transports, taking it down the Potomac and up the Rappahannock for a landing in Johnston's rear, the last thing he wanted now was any movement that might alarm the enemy at Manassas into scurrying back to safety. So he went to Lincoln and outlined for the first time in some detail the plan which would be spoiled by any immediate forward movement. Lincoln did not like it. It would endanger Washington, he said, in case the rebels tried a quick pounce while the Federal Army was making its roundabout boat trip to Urbana. McClellan then asked if he could submit in writing his objections to the president's plan and his reasons for favoring his own. Lincoln said, "All right, go ahead." While the general was preparing his brief, he received from Lincoln a set of questions dated February 3rd. "Does not your plan involve a larger expenditure of time and money than mine? Wherein is a victory more certain by your plan than mine? Would it not be less valuable in that yours would not break a great line of the enemy's communications, while mine would? In case of disaster, would it not be more difficult to retreat by your plan than mine?" In asking these questions, Lincoln was meeting McClellan on his own ground, and McClellan answered him accordingly, professionally ticking off the flaws in Lincoln's plan and pointing up the strong points of his own. At best, he declared,
The former would result in nothing more than a barren and costly victory which would leave still harder battles to be fought all the way to Richmond, each time against an enemy who would have retired to a prepared defensive position, while the Federal supply lines stretched longer and more vulnerable with every doubtful success. Whereas the latter, striking at the vitals of the Confederacy, would maneuver Johnston out of his formidable Bull Run entrenchments by requiring him to turn in defense of his capital and give battle wherever McClellan chose to fight him, with control of all Virginia in the balance. Supply lines would run by water, which meant that they would be secure, and in event of the disaster which Lincoln seemed to fear, the army could retreat down the York James Peninsula, an area which afforded plenty of opportunity for maneuver because, the soil being sandy, the roads were passable at all seasons of the year. Nor was this all. Besides its other advantages, he wrote, his plan had a flexibility which the other lacked entirely. If for some reason Urbana proved undesirable, the landing could be made at Mobjack Bay or Fortress Monroe, though admittedly this last would be less brilliant. As for the question as to whether victory was more certain by the roundabout route, the general reminded his chief that nothing is certain in war. However, he added, all the chances are in favor of this project. If Lincoln would give him the go-ahead, along with a little more time to get ready, I regard success as certain by all the chances of war. There Lincoln had it. In submitting the questions, he had said, if you will give me satisfactory answers, I shall gladly yield my plan to yours. Now that the young Napoleon had given them, Lincoln yielded, but not gladly. Though he liked McClellan's plan better now that the general had taken him into his confidence and explained it in detail, he was still worried about what Johnston's army, better than 100,000 men according to the Pinkerton reports, might do while McClellan's was in transit. Confederates in Washington might win foreign recognition for their government, and with it, independence. However, since McClellan had come out so flatly in favor of his own plan and in rejection of the other, Lincoln had no choice except to fire him or sustain him. And that, in fact, was no choice at all. To fire Little Mac would be to risk demoralizing the Army of the Potomac on the eve of great exertions. All the same, Lincoln did not rescind the order for an advance on the 22nd. He merely agreed not to require its execution. Whereupon the Radicals returned to the charge, furious that their demands had gone unheeded. Lincoln held them off as best he could, but they were strident and insistent. "For God's sake, at least push back the defiant traitors," Wade still cried. Lincoln saw that something had to be done to appease them, perhaps by clearing the lower Potomac of enemy batteries, or else by reopening the B&O supply line west of Harper's Ferry. Either would be at least a sop to throw the growlers. So he went again to McClellan, who explained once more that the rebels along the lower Potomac were just where he wanted them to be when he made his Urbana landing in their rear, forcing them thus to choose between flight and capture. It would be much better to have them there, he said, than back on the Rappahannock, contesting his debarkation. Lincoln was obliged to admit that as logic this had force. As for the reopening of the B&O, McClellan remarked that he had it in mind already. What he wanted to avoid was another Ball's Bluff or anything resembling the fiasco which had resulted from making a river crossing without a way to get back in event of repulse. He was bringing up from downriver a fleet of canal boats, which could be lashed together to bridge the upper Potomac. Across this newfangled but highly practical device, he would throw a force for repairing and protecting the railroad, a force that would be exempt from disaster because its line of retreat would be secure. Lincoln liked the notion and was delighted that something at last was about to be done. Then came word from McClellan that the project had had to be abandoned because the boats turned out to be 6 inches too wide for the lift locks at Harper's Ferry. Once more Lincoln was cast down, his expectations dashed, and Secretary Chase, a solemn, indeed a pompous man, got off his one joke of the war. The campaign had died, he said, of lockjaw. Washington's birthday came and went, and the Army of the Potomac remained in its training camps, still awaiting the day when its commander decided that the time had come for it to throw the roundhouse left designed to knock Virginia out of the war. In the West, meanwhile, Thomas had counterpunched Crittenden clean out of East Kentucky, and Grant had delivered to Sidney Johnston's solar plexus, the 1-2 combination that sent him reeling all the way from Bowling Green to northern Alabama. Burnside, down in North Carolina, had rabbit-punched Huger and Wise, and even now was following up with a series of successes. Everywhere, boldness had been crowned with success. Everywhere, that was, except in Virginia, where boldness was unknown. Stanton could see the moral plainly enough, and when Greeley came out with an editorial praising the new secretary and giving him chief credit for the victories — he had been in office exactly a month on the day Fort Donelson fell — Stanton replied with a letter that was printed in the Tribune, declining the praise and making a quick back thrust at McClellan in the process. Much has been said recently of military combinations and organizing victory. I hear such phrases with apprehension. They commenced in infidel France with the Italian campaign and resulted in Waterloo. Who can organize victory? We owe our recent victories to the Spirit of the Lord that moved our soldiers to rush into battle and filled the hearts of our enemies with terror and dismay. We may well rejoice at the recent victories, for they teach that battles are to be won now